I'm Henry St. John from the US Rates Strategy Team, and you're listening to At Any Rate, our global research podcast, where we take a look at the story behind some of the biggest trends, themes, and industries in markets today. I'm joined today by Josh Younger and Mika Inkinen to talk about cryptocurrency taking its first stress test. So Josh, didn't the Bitcoin bubble already burst? Why are we talking about it now?
Yeah, so very much so. Bitcoin was famously sort of tulip-level bubble quality and burst quite spectacularly and spent quite a few years at relatively depressed prices. But what's been interesting over the past few years is the benign market environment in which that has occurred. And there have been periods of incremental stress, but since the cryptocurrency asset class grew in notoriety and activity, there really hasn't been a significant market event for it to weather. And so the interesting question is, when that crisis comes, which it came in April, March of this year, you know, how does that particular asset class perform relative to others? Because in a world that's starved for liquidity, a relatively illiquid and smaller and novel asset class like cryptocurrency could face a much more existential threat, or it could survive. And its survival is a very interesting piece of information for its potential longevity. So we see the past few months as a critical test of whether or not assets like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, whether or not you believe that they have true value as a currency in the sense of medium of exchange or store of value, you know, will it survive as an asset class? Is very much a relevant question over the past few weeks.
Okay, Mika, so turning to you, how do you think about intrinsic value when it comes to cryptocurrency?
Well, so defining an intrinsic value for a cryptocurrency can clearly be challenging, and there are a wide range of views on this, ranging from those who argue that they have no intrinsic value at all, to those who estimate fair values well above kind of current market prices. The approach we've taken is essentially to treat Bitcoin effectively as a commodity, and base it on the marginal cost of production. The logic here being that mining Bitcoin consumes electricity, and that results in a real-world cost that's incurred in nominal currency terms by miners. And in principle, if the market price is above the cost of production, then that should induce miners to increase resources to mine coins, and that increased hashing power will kind of adjust difficulty higher, and the combination of the two means that the cost of production increases. Conversely, if the market price is below the marginal cost, then that should induce higher cost producers to exit, reducing hashing power, and that in turn reduces difficulty and again reduces the cost of production. So what we've followed is essentially a methodology adopted in a paper by an academic, Hayes, and that estimates first the daily cost of production as a function of computational power employed, the cost of electricity, and efficiency of mining hardware. We then kind of estimates an expected number of Bitcoins produced daily as a function of kind of the block reward, hashing power employed, and the difficulty of the algorithm. And when you take the ratio of the two, we get essentially the marginal cost of production per unit of Bitcoin. Now, clearly, there's variation across miners, and particularly with whatever your local price of electricity is, because that's the major marginal cost. But effectively, the approach aims to look at the cost of production as a typical or representative miner.
And how did the halving figure into this? What can we learn from it?
Well, so the halving event, by halving the block reward, it essentially doubled the cost of production per unit of Bitcoin. And ahead of the halving event, we would argue that if you assume that market participants are kind of rational and prices are forward-looking, the market was essentially pricing in a significant cut in mining activity as the market price was trading well below what the implied intrinsic value would be once you halve the block reward. And certainly the first 2 weeks after the halving event kind of suggests that as miners responded to that collapse in revenues by shutting down less efficient rigs, as the combination of sharp falls in hash rate and increased implied efficiency of mining rigs based on estimates by DigEconomist, the combination of those two saw the intrinsic value essentially drop by 20% in the first 2 weeks after. So, I mean, the halving event, along with the March price correction, I think, demonstrates that miners can respond quite aggressively to significant falls in their revenues, even as they respond maybe a bit less quickly to market prices trading kind of above their cost of production.
So, Josh, back to you. What can we learn about cryptocurrency from its relationship to other asset classes?
So the test case of March and April is very interesting in a couple of ways. The first is, given the broader drive towards liquidity within the asset class, so intra-cryptocurrency, was there an outperformance of those tokens, which are typically more actively traded, more actively used, you know, deeper markets, et cetera, and really Bitcoin stands out quite a bit by that measure, and to a lesser extent, Ethereum and Ripple. So so-called altcoins versus more top-tier tokens. And what we see is a rise in correlation between all of those different components of the asset class. So very little evidence of a flight to liquidity within cryptocurrency. So that is supportive of its longevity because you didn't see sort of collapsing prices in less liquid tokens. The second question is, did this asset class in Bitcoin in particular behave like a medium of exchange, which would imply very stable prices, or at least a volatility on par with something like a trade-weighted US dollar? Did it trade like a store of value in tandem with gold, for example, or other stores of value? Because, of course, gold is not really functionally a medium of exchange. It's much more a store of value. In that sense, it's not a currency in the traditional sense, but it is sort of consistent with some concepts of the role that Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies might play in a more digital global economy. And the last question is, did prices simply collapse and not recover? And that would be a scenario in which the flight to liquidity leads to a large-scale exit from the asset class. And then in the middle of that, you have risky assets like stocks and corporate bonds and things like that. And so what we saw in April and March was a significant shift in the correlation structure of cryptocurrency versus other assets. So it didn't simply keep doing what it had been doing before. Its relationships to other asset classes changed in a material and significant and rapid way. But rather than trading in tandem with gold and other stores of value or medium of exchange type conceptions like a trade-weighted US dollar, you really see Bitcoin trading with equities. And so that suggests that cryptocurrency in general, and this is true of other tokens as well, but Bitcoin in particular, took on a lot of the characteristics of a risky asset class during a period of significant market stress. And, you know, on the one hand, you have intrinsic value as a functional, if not leaky floor. So that suggests that there wasn't a run type dynamic developing in cryptocurrency. But it also suggests that, you know, the underlying value of this thing is perceived to be, you know, somewhat high risk, and in that sense, speculative. So our conclusion is that the fact that the asset class kind of survived this test is positive for its longevity, in that this is likely to be a place where capital is put to work to some extent for a reasonably long period of time. It survived its stress test, but it did not display the aspects of that you would associate with like digital gold or other sort of stores of value or with a widespread medium of exchange. And so, you know, over the long term, you'd expect Bitcoin to trade more like equities and other risky assets, especially during times of stress.
So we saw that a breakdown of market structure and liquidity was a key driver of rates and other markets in March and April. How well did cryptocurrency markets hold together over this period?
Yeah, that result was somewhat surprising and very interesting. So what we did was we looked across the more traditional asset classes, particularly those that were in focus in March and April, and that was equities, fixed income, foreign exchange, and gold. And we have reasonably good market microstructure data for all of them. And the question was, you know, how did liquidity evolve? And for liquidity, we looked at the depth of the order book. So basically, how much size could one transact in before significantly moving the price on a typical day in, let's say, mid-March through early April? And unsurprisingly, all of those depth measures collapsed pretty spectacularly and took a reasonable amount of time to recover. I mean, across all of those asset classes, commodities, foreign exchange, fixed income, and equities, we're not quite back to one-year average levels yet. So the recovery has been slow. Bitcoin, on the other hand, we also have depth data for. And the collapse in depth was comparable, if not more significant than most of those other asset classes, but the recovery was much more rapid. And so within a couple of weeks, market depth across major exchanges in cryptocurrency was back to, if not above, levels that were typical of the prior year. And so the market microstructure of the cryptocurrency market, the liquidity provision mechanism, and overall liquidity conditions were, in fact, more resilient than traditional asset classes. And that, again, points to an absence of run-type dynamics. So in a sense, you know, this is another way to think about surviving the stress test, is to say, is the structure of the underlying market that trades this thing, in this case, cryptocurrency, is it resilient to broader stressors? And in this case, the answer is very much yes.
Thanks, Josh, and thanks, Maker. Thanks for joining us. Stay tuned for more episodes of At Any Rate, JP Morgan's Global Research Podcast Series. This communication is provided for information purposes only. Please read JP Morgan research reports related to its contents for more information, including important disclosures. Copyright 2020, JP Morgan Chase & Co., all rights reserved. This episode was recorded on June 17, 2020.